Welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast, hosted by Dave Roberts. Humanity possesses a unique skill, the ability to pass knowledge from one generation to the next. This podcast embraces that ability, offering learning opportunities through conversations with extraordinary guests. Dave aims to leave a positive mark on individuals around the world. So before you dive into today's episode, please share this podcast with your network, including friends, family, and colleagues. And please consider leaving a rating or review. Your support makes all the difference.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts. And today it is my pleasure to have as my guest, David Schatzkammer. David is a licensed mental health counselor and registered play therapist supervisor specializing in helping young children thrive through therapeutic play. As founder and director of the Center for Play Therapy, David brings over 15 years of experience working with children ages 3 to 8, supporting families through challenges like ADHD, trauma, behavioral struggles, and emotional regulation. He trained at the University of North Texas's Intensive Play Therapy Supervision Program and continues to lead supervision groups and serve on the board of the Association for Play Therapy of New York State. David's approach is deeply practical, blending clinical expertise with simple, powerful tools parents can use to build stronger relationships with their kids. He's also the co-author of the soon-to-be-published Easy Schmeasy Guide to Parenting, a hands-on book packed with therapeutic techniques that actually fit into everyday life. Whether in the therapy room, training other professionals, or sharing insights on podcasts, David's mission is to make play-based healing accessible, effective, and meaningful. And with that, David, welcome to the Teaching Journeys podcast. It's a pleasure having you on the program today.
Thanks so much, Dave. It's really a pleasure to share with you more.
We met through a podcast agent by the name of Noemi Barris, who's referred several guests to my podcast. And when I found out that your specialty was in play therapy, it resonated deeply with me because as an adjunct faculty member at Utica University in the Psych Child Life Department, play is very much a part of our curriculum of courses. So I was anxious to talk to you and get your takes on play therapy and working with children. So I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Likewise.
All right. My first question for you is tell our audience about the experience or experiences that have contributed to your life path and your passions for play therapy.
For kids, I always enjoyed working with kids. Whether it was as young as, I could remember as young as like 14 years old, I worked in different camps. I was in charge of different special need kids. It kind of was kind of like an all-natural type of segue into my career, working with kids in different places, volunteering different agencies. I just love them. I enjoy them. I get them. I have patience for them. And that's how we're developing to more of like kind of what I do, you know, what I love doing.
Yeah, I mean, I know a lot of therapists, and not a lot of therapists can work effectively with children. I think it takes a unique set of skills to be able to do that, and particularly with the age group that you work with.
There's a lot of therapists who want to work with kids, but not necessarily know how to or are scared to. So it definitely resonates. But I think if more therapists were, they want to, but they don't know how to, they might really enjoy it, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we can learn a lot from kids and from working with children. They can teach us a lot about life and just how they see the world. Now, you are the founder and director of Center for Play Therapy. So what inspired the creation of your organization? And what does a typical therapy or therapy sessions look like with the children and families that you deal with?
Sure. I wanted a place to really focus on play in terms of the feel, the approach, everything is more of like a playful area. There's no like telephones and chairs and computers. It's like really a playroom, or really a play-based place where kids, parents, and even professionals come to train in play therapy. Kids I work with are ages 3 to 8. 3 to 8 is my sweet spot, because once you get a little bit older, kids get more cognitively available. They could talk more. They could have conversations with you. They could process things differently. And they're playing books differently. Like, you're not going to take a 10, 12-year-old and play, you know, with a house with them or like a kitchen set. It's a little bit too, they're too old for that. They could process things differently, you know? They could talk about things differently. And 3 to 8 is something that's just my wheelhouse. I know it. I could talk the same language. I know the same language, you know? I remember a story. I had a 5-year-old and the mother came into my place and she sat the 5-year-old down, okay? And she told the 5-year-old, okay, tell her how you feel. It's not going to work like that. I'm sorry. No 5-year-old is going to tell me how they feel, you know? I work with kids like from trauma-related, ADHD, behaviorally, self-esteem, parents from divorce homes, school issues, pretty much for the gamut of what kids go, you know, like what kids go through.
So speaking of ADHD, do you find that it's commonly misdiagnosed, or do you think, you know, are there other factors that could contribute to distractibility and hyperactivity other than an ADHD diagnosis?
Yeah, in my practice, I don't really diagnose kids. Not my cup of tea to do that. I kind of see the whole holistic child and the family as a one unit. I guess across my lifespan and when I'm working with kids, maybe less than a handful really had ADHD. Like they really had that diagnosis. You could really tell, and they probably some of them really needed the medication they were on. But for the most part, it could be a lot of different things. It could be environmental. It could be also speech. Could be, you know, sometimes when parents come in to me and they say, my kid is ADHD, I would say, did they have a hearing test? Do they have processing issues? Because it could overlay with processing and ADHD. So I really want to make sure, like, I'm the best person treating for your child. And it's not like, say, a hearing issue or a neurological thing or something else might be that I might not be the best therapist, you know?
Yeah, and I think you made a really good point about differential diagnosis. Is we have to take a look at context. We have to take a look at what's going on in that child's life, you know, before anybody who's privileged to make a diagnosis makes a diagnosis.
Right. And it could be a lot of, it could be a whole slew of things, but I don't necessarily treat the diagnosis, more I treat the kid and the family. You know, to be perfectly blunt, I don't really care what the paper says. I remember once there was a parents that came in and they had an 8-year-old. And they were telling me about their kid. And on the paper, while getting the information, it seemed like the kid was autistic. And that's one thing I don't work with in my office, autistic, because it's a very specialized play. It's different. It's not my regular go-to thing. I told the parents, I want to refer you out to someone else, because I'm not the best person for you. And they were like pushy, like, just see him once, just meet him once, see what you can do. Like, they were like, making me a bit mischievous, as they say. So I said, listen, I'll see him once. I'll let you know. I'm saying, I get a feeling for it. I'll let you know. And he came in once, and it was a whole different kid from on paper, like day and night. I said, yeah, your son I can work with.
Yeah.
Something definitely not exactly what you're saying on paper that matches what he's showing me.
I tell my students at Utica University, it's important to assess the entire situation. It's important to take a look at its social history, contextually, what's going on with the family. You made also a very good point, is that we need to treat the child and the family as one unit, because you can't treat the child without the family. It doesn't work that way.
Right.
I know you mentioned you deal with children who are 3 to 8 years of age. How have you found play to be able to strengthen communication and behavioral outcomes for that group specifically?
So children often lack the vocabulary and the emotional insight to explain their world, inner world. And they usually will do it best through symbolic and imaginary play, like dolls, animals, puppet, role-playing, Minch's cars. And they really, really, really can symbolically showcase what the world is like, what their inner world is like. And that gives them a language to communicate. Now, most adults don't understand that. I get that language. We talk the same language. I talk kid language, you know? So sometimes adults, we try to make logic. Like, why is my kid doing this? Like, it doesn't make sense. Like, it's not logic. Okay, but he's in a world of play, and you're an adult, and we're in a world of logic. So doesn't really match unless you learn the skills of play and how the kid communicates so you can communicate with them back with that, you know? And some kids do it through storytelling, like puppet shows and narratives and sandboxes and stuff like that to help them express that communication. Like, you're not going to have a 3-year-old, 4-year-old, 5-year-old with vocabulary and tell you how they're feeling. But they might play out a scene in the house. They might play out scenes that come up in the kitchen or in a puppet theater, you know, that kind of thing, you know, that on that communication type of thing.
Yeah, I think at that age group, they tend to be more sensory motor anyway. They tend to be more hands-on and, you know, less symbolic, but as it is just, you know, their symbolism is actually communicated through play, through how they set up certain scenarios. I think you could tell a lot with what's going on just from how they do that.
Yeah, and when the children direct their play and make decisions, they feel empowered. They feel like they boost their self-esteem, self-confidence. And that translates into better behavior as well because they have a healthy sense of self awareness, healthy sense of confidence they can do through play.
Yeah, so essentially they can become empowered and also develop some autonomy and self-efficacy as well.
Yeah.
Well, let's say I have a three-year-old that I'm bringing into you for treatment, and I want some just simple everyday techniques that can help me nurture an emotional connection with my child in an age-appropriate way. What are some things that I could do?
One is actually play. You know, sometimes parents, they want to play, structured games, board games or things that have rules. But sometimes the best play for kids, especially that age, is unstructured, play dollhouse with them, building blocks with them, play house with them, play puppets with them, you know, really getting on the floor and actually playing and actually getting interested in their own world. Like I tell parents, carve out a half an hour a week with your kid and just it's a date with your kid and playing for half an hour, whatever they want. They can do whatever they want with no expectation. They got to follow the rules and make the rules. Just simple play type of thing, you know, that's a really big task that seems hard in this world we live in with a lot of things we have to do and responsibilities, paying bills and school and activities and whatnot. But that's a real component that's missing that actually helps out everything else in the kid's life and your life too as a parent. So that's one big thing I definitely stress on. Also, which is very hard, I would be very empathy with parents, with kids, which is a hard thing to do in itself, but that's definitely helps in the communication and the relationship.
I think the importance of showing your child that you understand them and that you are attempting to understand them is a powerful message to send.
Right. And you mentioned that, you know, in the beginning, I think you mentioned that I have a book coming out, The Easy Sweezy Guide to Parenting. And the goal for that book is to have small takeaways that parents can do with their kids that's relationship-based and can have massive impact. And one of them that I like a lot is you can write your kids notes. I leave my kid note, have a good day, I love you, it was nice hearing from you, we had supper together. A simple thing to leave their kid a note that could be in their mailbox, in their lunchbox, could be on their bed, and just leave it. Now, sometimes parents tell me, okay, but my 4-year-old doesn't know how to read, right? But I'm like, okay, but your kid knows how to look at pictures. You could draw a heart. You could draw a picture for them. And it has the same impact, and they know that too. So some parent actually took that on. I told her, one of my coaches decided to implement this picture thing. And she started drawing pictures for her son. And she told me what happened very, very cool was her son started drawing pictures for her. So I said, okay, whatever you're doing is right on the money.
Yeah, and that's a great way to develop a relationship without words with the 4-year-old.
Yeah. It's such a simple thing you can do. It takes 30 seconds, a minute to draw something, to write something, but have massive impact in the relationship and your family and everything else, you know? So that book is kind of like a whole slew of stuff that's packed into that, takeaway. Even if you just do one thing in the book, you can have a lot of good impact, you know?
Now, when is your book scheduled to come out?
I think it's coming out August time. It should be on Amazon in August.
Good. That'll be one book I'll be looking for. That'll be a good resource for me in terms of working with my students as well, too.
It's a good book.
Well, yeah, I mean, there's going to be your experience as a play therapist, a lot of love that you have for children. It's going to be reflected in that.
Yeah.
In your writing. And that's, and I like books that have takeaways. They not only present theory, but just say some practical points to say, what can we do to enhance relationships with those people that we love, with our children, with our spouses? What are some simple things or one or two things that we can do that'll change the landscape of our relationships with those people we care about?
Like packed in without the psychobabble, you know?
Yeah, I mean, the older I get, David, the less psychobabble, you know, I appreciate. I just like, give me the nuts and bolts. Tell me what it is I need to do so that I can communicate this to somebody in a way that they're going to understand. Because psychobabble is great for the person that's developing it, but if the other person doesn't understand what it means, it's
right.
The techniques are going to be lost.
Yeah.
Any other tips that you would like to suggest besides drawn pictures? Anything else that kind of come into mind?
You know, sometimes parents, kids get angry, upset, or this back and forth type of thing. Misunderstanding, miscommunication, a big thing. I thought the kids thought, parents said something, parents thought the kid understood them. So something that I like to do with parents and kids is create like a code word. If you're getting upset or you're getting frustrated or whatever, let's just say a word that we both know we have to like take time out and recharge. So I do with my daughter because sometimes I can get too playful in a way. And it gets across as annoying. So we came up with a code word, applesauce. We made up a word, applesauce. We say applesauce. Anyone said applesauce, we know we back off. Okay, we stop. And it works very nicely, you know?
Yeah.
Because the code word really comes down to you understand and your kid understands.
Yep.
And you know what the meaning behind that word means. So there's no lack of communication. We both know what does it mean, and we both know what it stands for, and it's playful in a way also.
Yeah. And it also signals that, hey, we need to take a break from each other for a little bit. We need to take a time out. And I think that's one of the things that I think it's important to impress upon parents is that sometimes you and your kids are going to need some time out. Yeah. So, you know, develop that kind of understanding. Like you said, I like the idea of a code word that says, okay, we just need to maybe take a little break from each other. Then let's check back with each other and see if we're ready to go or ready to resume the conversation. If not, we respect that boundary and we come back when we're ready again. It's like even with adults who are having difficulties dealing with each other or angry with each other, you're not going to resolve a conflict in the heat of the moment. You need to step back, recharge, and then revisit.
Right.
So yeah, when your book comes out, I'll probably be one of the first ones to purchase it on Amazon.
Yeah.
The other thing I wanted to ask you, and this just occurred to me during our conversation, what are the barriers that parents present to effectively engage and play with their children, other than the fact that logic gets in the way? Is there any history with the parents that you've discovered that gets in the way of them being able to just joyfully and freely play with their children?
I mean, parents go through a lot of things. They're anxious, they get tied up with things, they're busy, there's stress, paying bills, and life itself, just that itself, could be very stressful and getting in the way or affecting that communication. Like, it's like, becomes more like rote. Okay, we do this, we get up, we go this, we get dressed, we come back from school, we go this. It becomes very like monotonous. And then when something goes wrong, we get upset, we get frustrated, the kid gets upset. That's why I'm a very big fan of like just schedule a time. Even if it's 15 minutes, schedule. The phone's off, you know, and just play, but just be in that moment, you know?
Yeah. You know, I also think of parents who have come from unhealthy home situations where there's been a history of addiction or abuse. One of the rules that they've internalized is that life is a serious business and it's hard for them to have fun. It's hard for them to have play. So even when I've worked in the past as a clinician with adults who have come from that situation, I just try to structure in some time and say, let's see what you want to tap into. Just learn to have a little bit of fun and learn that life doesn't have to be a serious business. But it sounds like there's never a dull moment in your practice. Now, you're the only person, you are Center for Play Therapy.
I'm looking at two other people to bring on, but right now it's me.
And I'm sure you...
I'm very picky.
I would suspect you would be, and I would be too, particularly when you're working with children. You need to have somebody who's got the temperament, who's got the background, and who basically has the personality to be able to work effectively with children. So yeah, I'd be picky too. Because not, like you said, not everybody is equipped to do this.
Yeah.
So if somebody wanted to become a registered play therapist, what educational requirements do they need to meet? Let's talk about that first of all. Then I got a second part to that question.
You need to be a licensed therapist, I believe. You have to get continuing education classes. You got to be supervised by a supervisor. People who are interested in that can go online to the Association for Play Therapy. And they could, there's a specific tab there where you can download and figure out, okay, what do I need? How many credits? Who needs to sign off? A supervisor? It's definitely a process. It's not like you finish in 6 months and you become, what, you know, the God's gift to humanity. It's kind of like a work in progress. Like it probably takes about probably 2 years maybe, or a year and a half maybe. Yeah.
Yeah, so is there continuing education requirements?
Yeah, yeah. There are like every 3 years, I think you need a certain amount of credits to keep going with that way. If you want to stay credentialed, I guess you want to go in.
Yeah, I know for me, for the LMSW, it's like 36 hours every 3 years that I have to continuing education to maintain the credentials.
Obviously, for your license, you need continuing education. And also, if you want to maintain that play therapy certificate type of thing, then you need to get continuing education class too.
Now, if they also want to get the supervisory designation, how many years do they have to spend under a registered play therapy supervisor?
It's probably some time to get that.
So beyond the educational requirements, if somebody wanted to become a play therapist, we may have alluded to this earlier, but I'm going to ask you again anyway. What are the personal qualities that individuals need to become effective play therapists? I said, one, you got to like working with children. But
it's funny, you said, I gave a presentation once on play therapy, and I started off, if there's anybody here that does not like working with kids, this is not for you.
Yeah.
You shouldn't be in here if you don't like working with kids. Yeah, you need to really enjoy working with kids. You have to be interested, curious. You have to be able to, like, even your own self, personal self, be aware what triggers you, what works for you. That shows up in the playroom also. How you show up, you know?
So it's presence as well, too.
You got to be fully in the moment, like, fully there. Like, when I'm with a kid in a room, there's nothing else going on in the world. Like, I'm zoned in. Like, there's nothing else going on.
And I would guess, particularly at that age, they're pretty intuitive anyway.
Yes.
So if they sense that their parents are having a bad day or the therapist is having a bad day, they can tap right into that, and that affects how they interact with their surroundings.
Sure.
So, yeah, that's the first thing. If you don't like working with the kids, that isn't the profession for you. So
it's okay that you don't know how to, but you have to want to.
Yes.
You know, if you don't know how to, there's plenty of ways to learn how to.
Yeah, I mean, if you could admit your limitations but say, look, I want to learn, then if that's the case, then there's hope for that individual to become effective working with children, as long as they have the desire to improve their skills. Okay. If you could leave our listeners, and you've left our listeners with quite a bit in the time that we spent together, if you could leave our listeners with just one thing, the ultimate takeaway, David, what would that be today?
Get more comfortable with playing. Because a lot of adults, a lot of people don't feel comfortable with it, don't know how to, don't remember what it's like to be a kid in a way, you know? So if you could be playful in your own way, it could be singing, it could be dancing, it could be playing, it could be going out, playing ball, it could be something else, but just tap into that natural, God-given characteristic that we fail to utilize to the maximum ability.
And what if somebody says to you as an adult, I'm worried what other people are going to think if they see me acting goofy or not acting adult-like, what would you say to them?
So I'll share a story with you to illustrate that. So I was in a bakery, and there was some drinks that were very far away. So my daughter was in the store with me, and she's a teenager. She's 17. And she asked me, can you get it? Drink, it's very far away. So I told her, imagine you were a four-year-old. What would you do? She climbed on top of the thing, and she got it. Kids don't care what other people think. Better for worse. But you wanted something, you got it, you could figure it out, you problem solve, and you got it. And no one looked at you, no one cared about you, and if someone did, they're not going to tell you about it.
And the things that we worry about the most are the things that never happen anyway. And, you know, I think, like I said, if my child saw me doing that, they'd probably get a big kick out of it. And it's also kind of modeling curiosity, adventurous behavior, and taking control of your environment when you need to.
Yeah.
And also good problem solving and creative problem solving, which I think is important. That all of those characteristics, I think, can be modeled through play, especially with that age group.
Yeah.
David, if listeners want to get in touch with you, purchase your book when it comes out, find out more about the services you provide, what is the best way for them to do that?
A couple of ways. You can go online, www.center4playtherapy.com. They can call me on my phone, 718-715-9402. And they can go me on LinkedIn under David Schatzkammer.
And I'll make sure all of that information gets into the episode notes on both YouTube and my other podcast platforms. David, anything else you want to leave us with before we sign off today?
It's very nice to do this and share and talk about play.
And hopefully we could have another conversation in the future about more aspects of play. And when your book comes out too, maybe that would be be another time that we can get together and talk some more. So
sounds good.
Thank you again for spending time with us today. I enjoyed our conversation, and I look forward to more in the future.
Thank you. Yeah, me too, Dave.
And with that, that is a wrap on another episode of the Teaching Journeys podcast. I'm your host, Dave Roberts, wishing you peace.